Hey there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. And now, we hope you enjoy the show.
And welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. And today, if you can't guess, we're going to be talking about horror in D&D and other role-playing games today on Wandering DMs. And if you can't guess...
I warned Dan I was going to ham it up. But, oh well.
So, Paul is the appointed horror meister of the two of the Wandering DMs. So, for all your horror needs and questions and requirements, you should really Paul will be driving this session of Wandering DMs, and I will be receiving all of his great information and knowledge, and be the whipping boy if need be. Thank you, Paul, for bringing everything that you're about to bring to the show. You're a lot more experienced with horror than I am. So,
which isn't really to say much, honestly. I only got into horror maybe 5 years ago. That's when I really started diving into it. I sort of always knew. I think I'd gone to a Gen Con, where I had played a really good horror game. And I think it was just an accident. Like, there was nothing else in that time slot that I could do. I'm like, I'll play this random Cthulhu game.
Interesting.
And I had a great time. And I was like, I need to do this.
What's your background with, like, other... So you're talking gaming right now. What's your background with other media, like novels or movies?
So the funny thing is, my wife is a huge horror fan. That's like, if I'm away for the night, she puts on a horror movie to watch. And I've never been a huge fan of like straight up slasher, gory, whatever kind of horror films. I do enjoy ones that have a little more smarts to them, maybe a little like a twist or an O. Henry moment or something like that.
Yep.
I'm concerned. I'm gonna ditch the hat. Sorry, everyone. I know you love the hat.
Okay. The hat is
the hat is gone. Now I feel like I'm at a campsite. Okay.
Feel pretty scary, yeah.
Okay. So, where was I? So other media, right? Yeah. So I definitely enjoy stuff like the Blair Witch Project. Excellent movie.
Okay.
Amazing movie. So I like that a lot. And then as for fiction, like I've read some Lovecraft. You know, that's an easy leap for me from already being a fan of other sort of pulp era writers.
Okay.
I guess that's about it. That's all I'm coming up with. What about you?
I have a real... So for many, many years, I avoided horror almost religiously. And I possibly... You know, someone could possibly point a finger and say I'm oversensitive about certain things. So I have I have a real history since I was a kid of, like, in theory, wanting to do the Halloween costume thing and then being driven to a, it's sort of embarrassing, being driven to a preschool Halloween event or a Halloween party and then just freaking the hell out, like, once I got on the premises and having to be taken away, actually. Right. And, you know, kudos to my father, because I remember, you know, being excited to go to a preschool Halloween party, drive to the location in my dad's car, and then a bunch of other kids show up in the window in their costumes, and I just lost it. I just lost it. Right. It's like, I'm like, there's no way I can deal with this. And my dad's like, okay, all right,
we're
no problem.
Then.
And he just turned around and just drove home. And that was without any complaint whatsoever. Right.
Wow.
So I have avoided, I've never read a horror novel, and I have scrupulously avoided horror movies until about 6 years ago. And for some reason, now my partner Isabel has watched a lot of horror movies in the past. And about 6 years ago, for some reason, we went to a trip to Ireland and we didn't have too much else to do. And we just binged on a horror movie marathon that they were having on TV. And so I've seen a number of things. Usually when like a big horror movie comes out in the theaters now, I actually do go to see that. And like probably my go-to, like if it does interface with medieval type stuff that you could use in D&D, that's certainly my favorite.
Right.
So like among my favorite movies is The Keep, if you've ever seen that.
I think I have.
It's really wonderful. It's set in World War II. It's in a medieval castle. A bunch of Nazis come in to set up a base in the castle, but the castle has a problem. And so you have a big kind of mishmash of, you know, Nazism bias, resistance fighters, supernatural elements, and just an amazing cast. When you see the cast, you will not believe who's in it. And they Mayfair Games actually wrote an actual D&D supplement based on that movie. So when I saw that, I was suddenly like, this is stuff I can use, and this is really fascinating, called The Keep.
Awesome. I added that to my list. I'm going to go look it up.
So for me, it's new. So for me, even being interfacing in any way whatsoever with horror movies, with horror topics, is new, and I don't run horror-specific gaming systems. But I will say that the one that I played was a player with you last year when you were running it, I think was the single most amazing gaming experience that I've ever had.
Well, thank you very much.
It immediately opened me up to the possibilities of what's done in those.
I would make a possibly contentious statement that horror gaming is really about dwelling in mood and cliche and evoking that mood of horror and not actually about scaring the participants.
Okay.
Like, I feel like movies, horror movies, they're doing everything they can to scare the audience, right? Like to the point of, like, more likely it's, like, the audio cues or, you know, cinematographic.
Yep.
Can't say that word. You know, effects, right? Like interesting cuts or whatever to kind of shock you and startle you, right? Generally, I'm not looking for that in a horror game. I think it's fleeting and difficult to pull off. And ultimately, not really worth it.
Okay, interesting.
I would much rather just have us. For me, I think that horror is about kind of dwelling in the metagame, right? Like when we watch a horror movie, we delight at yelling at the idiot going up the stairs. What are you doing? Don't go up there! Don't you know? Right? Like we love knowing a little more than the characters know. And that play of like, oh, I understood the foreshadowing that came earlier, and I know a little bit, but not a lot, and I'm making guesses about what's going on. And anyway, I think that when I'm playing horror games, that's what I love, the detachment between me and my character, and watching my character do truly stupid things that I know that where I like really like going for 100% sort of immersement, right?
Right.
I would be like, no, I'm not. I would leave, right? If I was going for real immersion in a horror game, then I, in the first 15 minutes, I'd be like, see you guys, I leave.
Yep, gotcha. Yep, understood. So Andre in the comments is, thank you for the supportive comment, actually. I think I needed to hear that, first of all. And I think he just said that there's a difference between possibly scaring the characters versus scaring the players. And I actually think this sort of feeds into like the primary question that I wanted to develop, actually. Respond to that. So how much are you trying to, so it sounds like in your games, you're more damaging the characters than the players.
Yes, absolutely.
Is your expectation. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I'm looking for in a horror game. I want, okay, so when we talk about horror gaming, it's interesting. Like one of the things, I'm going to be plugging this a lot. In this episode, I have a product called Insanity Cards, which is an insanity mechanic that you can layer into any RPG. There's a crowd sale going on right now, just literally launched at the same time as this video went live. So check it out, paulsgameblog.com/insanitycards. So anyway, when I was building that, I built that because I was dissatisfied with the insanity mechanic that I was seeing in Call of Cthulhu or any horror game that I was playing at a convention. And it's usually a convention. I almost exclusively play horror in conventions. I've never played a long-running horror campaign.
Right.
And
I was wondering about exact addicts.
Yeah, I've played it. I seem to remember that our friend Scott once ran a Cthulhu game for us, for our group, back when we were gaming together. That was like set in World War One, and we were all two. Was it World War Two? There you go.
Yeah,
and that was a couple of sessions. I think it was more than one. I think
you're right. Maybe two or three.
Maybe two or three. Yeah. Something like that. But I'm used to that short form because my expectation is that my character is screwed. That my character is either going to attempt to do something heroic and die horribly, or my character is going to succumb to seeing things that man was never meant to see and go wildly insane.
Right.
So when I run games at conventions, when I run horror games, I state that is the first thing I say at the table every single time. I say, my goal in this game is that every single player at this table either dies and or goes horribly insane by the end of the session.
Right.
I don't think every horror GM runs it that way.
How would it be different?
Mm.
In my limited experience, I'm mostly pinging off you, actually. So how would it be different?
So imagine, if you will. So recently I've been doing some research for a new horror adventure I'm writing that is set in the early 90s and involves a lot of going underwater. So I watched the movie The Abyss. Have you seen that?
I think I did. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, it was pretty popular. Came out in 89, I think.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, at that time, there was a real strong interest in this, and so it spun off like half a dozen other movies, all kind of about the same thing, sort of weird science fiction / horror underwater. So you have movies like Leviathan or Deep Star 6 or The Sphere, all these movies, right? Okay, so...
And it's kind of not too far removed from like an Alien movie.
Yes, correct.
Right.
Correct. Well, underwater and space are very similar in that regard, right? Like, it's dangerous. You can't live in that environment without a lot of protective gear. We don't know what's there, right?
Right.
A lot of unknown, right? Yeah. So, the interesting thing about The Abyss specifically is some of those other movies skew much more towards the horror bent, The Sphere less so, but like Leviathan or something like that, is much more about like, oh God, there's a horrible monster and everyone's going to die.
Yeah.
In The Abyss, a couple people die, but it turns heroic, right?
Yep.
The characters band together and they overcome the terrible thing, right? And the ending is almost uplifting. Like the ending, especially if you see the extended version, by the way, I recommend it, but it's like 3 hours long. the ending is very much like, hey, the human race might just survive kind of ending.
I guess I've heard about the extended bit. Yeah, yeah. Right.
So there's, and I've played plenty of Cthulhu games like that where the DM has not ruled that out. And possibly the game ends that way, that the players overcome, that it becomes more adventuresome. And for me, this is the major difference for me between playing, say, straight D&D and horror D&D.
Okay. Right?
If I'm going to play horror D&D, I'm going to make that promise to my players up front. I'm going to kill you or make you insane by the end of the game. Whereas in straight D&D, you can have horror elements, but you still kind of expect to come out on top at the end.
So I've gotten in. So this is what I was this is what I was discussing with my partner Isabel today at breakfast, and a little later in the show we're gonna be talking about extra benefits to our patrons, and so maybe tell us whether one of the extra benefits is if you want to see the pre-show version where I discuss the show at breakfast with my partner Isabel. on
Sunday
morning, which apparently is now briefing at breakfast, as we call it now.
That's awesome. I want to see that.
I sit down and go, I don't know what I'm going to talk about. And she goes, well, what about this and this? I go, oh, yeah, that's great. Anywho, I have gotten in the habit of actually saying that most of my D&D games turn into horror games. And maybe that's a weird thing. Maybe that's a weird thing to say. But I have had a couple, I have had a number of cases now where just in a normal play session, my actual players at the table will actually jump or the whole table will go, oh, God, no, like that. Right. And inevitably, it's not something that I expected or planned on.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I think that the times when that happens is when there's a combat happening, and I feel like I'm giving just a completely objective, clinical, medical description of an injury from, you know, melee combat with a sword or an axe or an arrow.
Yep.
And, you know, for what it's worth, my parents are both medical professionals, right? So I grew up seeing medical procedures happening all the time. Mm-hmm. And so I find that if I give what I think is just a completely objective description of something, frequently the players at my table will go, oh God, that's too much. And so, you know, and sometimes it could be undead related or something like that. And so I actually do unintentionally get jumps out of my actual players. And obviously I'm running what I think is traditional straight D&D. And so it's kind of interesting that in my D&D games, you know, traditional, there could be death at any moment. And it could come by surprise, and it could come by a level drain, or it could come from, you know, save or die poison effect. And so around any particular corner, regardless of your character's story arc, I guess, or, you know, future possibilities, it could be cut off. That thread could be cut off at any moment, possibly. And so we were wondering, you know, which is more horrible?
Right.
Which is more horrible, to have death at any particular moment, you know, by surprise, not when you want it, or option B, to be completely fated with, you absolutely know you're going to go insane and destroyed gradually, and there's nothing you can do to prevent it. So we were kind of debating about which is more horrible, the thing that you could have gotten out of,
yep,
or the thing that you couldn't get out of. Yep. And I actually don't know what the answer is to that.
So
I'm crazy.
Oh yeah, sorry. I have a million things to react to now. Okay, so on the last point, again, my declaration is, it is my goal to make you
right,
all dead and or insane by the end of the night. I don't
right,
always 100% hit that. And
right,
so I think a lot of the fun there is knowing, like,
right,
this is our expectation. Like, we're turning that part of it up to 11. Like, probably going to die.
Yep.
Probably
yep,
going to go insane.
Okay.
Maybe not, and I don't know exactly when or how.
Okay.
Right,
yeah.
So I think that's still very fun, but there's still that sort of surprise element or unknown element to it. But we're just in the right mindset that we're not going to be, you know, some players might be upset by that, right? Some players, you can imagine
yeah,
playing, sitting down at D&D and being like, "Ah, I died! What the hell? Damn
yeah,
it! I really liked my character."
Right,
and at these convention games, I'm telling people, don't like your don't fall in love with your character. Right? You can like your character, but enjoy. Enjoy their descent, right? Enjoy
yeah,
their unwinding. That's the, when you were talking about sort of like the difference between like a surprise death, which is more horrible, a surprise death or like a fated death, right? The latter, I think, is very much more in the H.P. Lovecraft style of writing, right? Lovecraft,
yeah,
and I would say the reason there's not a lot of great Lovecraft adaptations to other media is that so much of that is internal. Right, I was reading
yeah,
Shadows Over Innsmouth recently, and
yeah,
the main character, if I was going to summarize the plot, I would say the main character goes to a town where there are terrible, horrible monsters, gets scared, and runs away.
Right.
That's the plot.
Gotcha.
Right? But there's
yeah,
pages upon pages of him being like,
right,
ooh, the horror! The
right,
horror!
Right. Right. I feel, okay, so it, like, I think I've read all of Lovecraft's Cthulhu mythos, I'm pretty sure, plus other stuff. And I feel like whenever I go back to Lovecraft, the thing that I'm like, every single time I'm re-surprised, because on page one, he always says, there's horrible, terrible things out there and massive cosmic gods and horrible
yep,
and things. And I'm like, you just gave it all away on page one. Like,
yep,
how does,
yep,
I don't get this, how you just gave the whole thing away on page one. And then inevitably later on, there actually is something even more horrible that he manages
mm-hmm,
to reveal.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always constantly surprised at how he can apparently turn the dial up to 11 on page one.
Yeah.
And then later on, I somehow, in it appearing that he's given the whole game away at the beginning, like, I get set up to
yeah,
get re-surprised and re-horrified by some other discovery.
I think I get a very similar effect from that opening statement I make. Like, everybody knows. Everyone at the table says, well, he said we're going to
okay,
go insane and die. But
okay,
I get pretty graphic, and, like, right, when we get into the actual event, it's still shocking and surprising to them. Like, yeah. Oh, I mean, yeah, you said I was going to die, but I didn't think this would happen.
All right, that's a great argument. That's
Let me go back. Because, so, I made a post on my blog earlier in the week that was about horror in D&D specifically. And I see Andre's asking us questions about how do the mechanics help or hinder horror themes. Several of my readers immediately responded with, well, original D&D is horror. Like, it is just a horror setting. Yeah. End of story.
I'm real close to that page. I want to say the same thing.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And I would say, again, the only difference, and this is something I want to play with and something I intend to play with at the upcoming Total Con, I'm running several sessions of D&D adventures plus insanity cards where I'm going to run an otherwise normal D&D adventure with normal D&D characters, but with that statement up front of, I intend to kill you or make you go insane by the end of this.
Yeah.
Right. And then play it that way. And then also I'll bring my insanity cards and add that in. And so D&D plus insanity and horrors. For me, essentially what I'm describing, and it's funny because all the adventures I'm running are written by him, is Lamentations of the Flame Princess. If you haven't read it, it's Lamentations of the Flame Princess by James Raggi. I started out by buying several of the adventures. I've got Death Frost Doom here and Anvil of the Gods. One that I think I'm going to run at Total Con is Something Stinks in Stilton, which is just wonderful and terrible. The fascinating thing is I bought about all those adventures. I love them. And so I'm like, well, I should buy the system that these are written for and find out what the deal is, right? So I bought the book, Lamentations of the Flame Princess.
Okay.
I read it, and I went, I don't need this. So the fascinating thing about Lamentations of the Flame Princess is there's nothing really horrible in it. And Raggy even says this, it's either in the foreword or possibly on his website somewhere, where he says, the point is that Lamentations of the Flame Princess is sort of the baseline. It is normal, right? It is D&D adventure world, so it basically reads just like any other retro clone, right? It's kind of old school D&D, cut and dry. Now, he does add some interesting flavor to some of the spells. So there's that. That's where I think the horror comes into it a little bit. But other than that, mechanics-wise, it's the baseline. It's not horror. The horror comes in the writing of all the adventures they produced for this, all of which are just chock full of horror.
Okay.
I would say the one and only mechanic in D&D that really provokes a horror-style play is how easy it is to kill the players.
I agree. Yeah. Yeah. So and of course in bog standard original D&D, it's just like you get to zero, you're done. That's it, you're dead. There's no death save, no negative hit points, no nothing. All that came later.
Yeah. The interesting thing is when I run modern horror, I use Savage Worlds and I remove a lot of the mechanics that make it harder to die. So I remove soaking, I remove the shaken status, I remove bennies, all these things that would save you from death. I yank those mechanics out because I want death to be ever-present.
Yep. And, of course, there are some gamers nowadays that, I mean, it's interesting, there are some gamers now that, and I shouldn't even say now because this has been a 20, 30-year process, who argue maybe you just shouldn't ever have death in your games. Maybe you shouldn't implement that as long as characters have interesting possible future plot threads. Just yesterday I saw someone on Twitter asking, should you ever have total player kill, total party kill? Should that ever be on the table? And of course I said absolutely yes.
Yeah.
But some people disagree with that.
I mean, I agree. In general, I agree that even if you're going for an adventure game, I think death needs to be there and present and terrifying because, like, it, I don't know, it takes the teeth out of the success if you don't have that.
Well, I say, like, if you're picking up a sword, right, and an essential part of your game is going to be battling someone with swords and knives, the whole point to that is that death is on the line.
Yep.
If your game was about politics and you're playing competing senators trying to pass legislation, different kind of thing. But for me, if you're like, I'm playing that I'm picking up a sword and battling someone, and death isn't a possibility, that starts to look a bit cartoonish
and
to me.
I think that's the interesting thing about D&D, right, is that from day one, it was always like an amalgam of all things fantasy, right?
True.
So all of this, like, I could totally imagine someone running a D&D game that's like, this is totally political, and everyone's going to be a senator, and yep. we're going to debate, right? Like, that's yep. legit. People run games like that, and that's fine.
Good point.
And I think it really, ultimately for me, comes down to my original thesis of it comes down to intent, right? When we sit down at the yep. table, what style of game are we intending to play? And for a horror game, I'm always going to nail you with that right at the beginning. My intent yep. is to kill you and make you go mad. Right. This is horror. This is yep. about watching your character
right.
devolve in the face of things that are just that he could never have comprehended before.
I mean, I could imagine like almost an accidental discovery of that. Like you start with, you know, miniature war games where you've got armies battling and they're just miniatures and you remove some miniatures. Right. Mm-hmm. And then the game sort of gets smaller and smaller scale. And, you know, like if you thought about like what does chess represent? Okay, well, it sort of represents a freaking massacre, right? Except that you don't normally think about it because you've got these abstract pieces in it. But if you played it out, like every single game of chess is a horrible mass murder situation. And so I could imagine like having war game miniatures and you're playing in this miniature style. And I guess in early D&D, people didn't bother to name their characters, but at some point, you know, pieces are removed and pieces are replaced.
Yep.
But then at some point you dial it down to where you're actually inhabiting one single person's experience, and all of a sudden there's this discovery that this is a horrible situation to be in.
You know, I think that's where it gets really interesting when you start talking about stuff that does not have an obvious end point, right? When you talk about real campaign-style play where you say, we're going to play this game from now until who knows, right? Yeah. That's where horror, I think, gets a little weird. And it always breaks my head a little bit of like, how do you run a long-term horror game? I'm not totally certain. And I've heard from a lot of people different ways you can do this, right? One is you just lean away from the horror a little, right? You make it, yeah, it's set, we're playing Cthulhu and it's set in the 20s and 30s and there are nasty things, but it's a little adventuresome because we expect you to overcome that.
Right.
And honestly, I ran a campaign back in the late 90s of Deadlands. Which is similar, yeah. right? It's Wild West, but also with zombies and other horrible, horrible things.
Yeah.
But we expect you to overcome that and win the day. So you right. could do that. That's one way. I heard one of my favorite suggestions was, well, we just play generations of characters. The characters die, yeah. and then we play the yeah. next people to pick up the pieces of the puzzle, right? We jump forward in the timeline or even just jump to the next day and say, oh, that whole group yeah. disappeared mysteriously. Let's play the people who investigate that disappearance.
Yeah.
And yeah. I kind of love that. I would play that
too.
Campaign.
I do too. Yeah. No, that actually is very attractive. That's great. I'm going to slightly change the topic.
Great.
The through line. So on Friday, so 2 days ago, I got a chance to see my partner's niece, who was performing in a production of the Magnus of Edgar Allan Poe. And so this is at, where was this? Outcry Theater in Plano, Texas is where this was. Mm-hmm. And so Isabel's niece, shout out to Julia, played the lead Edgar Allan Poe in the show, actually. Did a wonderful job. So shout out to Julia and her parents if they happen to listen to this. And we came back. And so it was interesting to kind of reflect on horror themes. You know, how does this feed into gaming? And we came away and Isabel actually said, why does D&D emphasize Lovecraft all the time and not something like Edgar Allan Poe, which was an interesting interesting challenge. And of course, you know, Lovecraft is built into the DNA of D&D, of course.
Yep.
If you look at the famous Appendix N literature listing that Gygax wrote in 1979, you know, it's got about 20 authors, but then he says, here's the most important six. Here's the six that were most had the most immediate influence on D&D, and Lovecraft is in the six.
Interesting.
Yeah, there's Robert Howard, and there's Fritz Lieber, mm-hmm. and DeCamp. I can almost remember all six. Vance that's it.
Yep.
Right, DeCamp's Lieber, Howard, Vance, and Lovecraft. And, of course, actually, Lovecraft had a pretty big influence on Robert Howard, actually.
Yep.
And so we were thinking about that, and I was like, well, you know, Poe is interesting, but his stuff is all very interpersonal interactions between two or three people. And of course, Lovecraft has all these really interesting, exotic, actual, you know, alien monsters and things like that. that feed really well into a party fighting dungeon type situation. So that's kind of obvious. But in addition, his you know, cosmic, here's a world building exercise that Lovecraft do is something I think that is pretty far away from what Poe does. And that certainly gives DMs an opportunity to build a possibly horrible, you know, cosmic world structure, which I really, really appreciate and certainly gets my creative juices running. Does that make sense? Or how?
Yeah,
like,
absolutely. I mean, that's on it, the funny thing is when I build my convention games, I'm always, for a long time, I wrestled with how to present them. What system do I call them? What type of game do I call them? Because, like, the players I want are the players who are really want to play Call of Cthulhu.
Yeah.
But I'm not running Call of Cthulhu. In fact, a lot of my games don't even focus on what is considered sort of traditional canon Lovecraftian mythos.
Okay, yeah.
I do not know the Lovecraftian mythos actually very well at all, to be honest.
Interesting.
Not really at all.
What?
Yeah. I know a little bit. I know a little bit, but really? I don't know a ton of it. Generally, what I do is, and so the term I fall back on a lot is cosmic horror. I'm writing cosmic horror, which is to say that usually my adventures revolve around one, investigating something that a situation that is already bad, right? Like a normal horror setting of, you know, we're in a war or this tragedy happened, people have died, whatever, something. That's already kind of bad.
Yeah.
People, you know, even, or even just like, you know, someone's missing. Someone's got abducted, right? Something that real world. But then layer on top of that, actually turns out what seemed like a normal real world level of horror is way worse. It is something supernatural or cosmic or whatever that we can't even comprehend and we don't believe existed at the beginning of the game. And now we're forced to confront this cosmic level dread.
It's interesting because that is very, I mean, that's very similar to what I said earlier about how I read Lovecraft's tactics is start out on page one and you're in a horrible situation and later on unbox the fact that it's far more horrible than you expected. That's a very Lovecraft movement.
I love that. That's you know, it's, and like you look at, again, I'll go back to The Abyss. Look at The Abyss, right? They thought that they were going to, like, rescue people out of a sunken sub.
Right.
And then it turned out, oh, no, it's like an unidentified craft. That's super weird. Right. Are there aliens? Right?
Yeah.
And, like, it just keeps lifting up. Oh, no, they're not aliens. Like, it's got normal human writing on it. Is this from the future?
Right. Yeah, that's very nice. It is interesting. I mean, again, if D&D is like this initial sous-sens of like every fantasy thing they could think of, like it's about 1/6 Call of Cthulhu right out of the box to begin with.
Yes. I mean, also think of, it's kind of funny, we dovetail a little bit into our conversation last week about Arneson, right? There was a whole adventure based around rescuing Arneson, wasn't there? Of like a sort of Paul Anderson-esque kind of setting where we live in the normal world, but then we get sucked into this strange fantasy world.
Yes.
Yeah. Delightful. I think that's a delightful setting to play in because again, compared to our actual lives or even our historic lives from anywhere in this past century, the world of D&D is pretty horrific.
I agree. Yeah, I agree. I was I'm about to dovetail this into a discussion about like Warhammer because like some people like I know you and Jen are big fans of Warhammer fantasy roleplay and the, you know, wonderful world building that they've done for that. And like as more of a D&D addict, I'm like, you know, D&D is pretty horrible already, right? So when Warhammer fans talk about it being, you know, grim and dark and gritty, I'm like, that is D&D to me. It's pretty grim and dark and gritty already. If this is on topic, what does Warhammer add to the mix to make it more?
I would say the biggest element that it adds is that you live in a society that generally does not believe in the things that you're facing.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
So okay. you go out there, you end up facing stuff that's way too powerful for you, that's gonna kill you and you're gonna die horribly. You manage to scrape by and get out of there by the skin of your teeth, just to then have the locals not believe you, and you're just to, now you're in danger of like getting locked up for being a lunatic, and so you run away to the next town, and it happens again.
Okay, basically, pretty good. I could, I mean, I could imagine. I mean, now I want that in my D&D game, right?
Yeah.
And I agree that I totally agree that not many people do play D&D like that, actually. And that's very, you know, that what you just said is very Fritz Lieber, Fafhrd and the Grey Mouser. Is they're constantly, they themselves are constantly expressing disbelief about what they are actually facing, as far as, well, they must have used mirrors or smoke or something like that, because that couldn't have possibly actually been a real demon. Those don't exist.
Yeah. It actually be a very interesting way, I think, to run a D&D campaign of like play straight D&D, but start with a world that doesn't believe that anything in the Monster Manual exists.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. I mean, and then the other thing, I mean, I think in the development, and then maybe a modification of the development of D&D, like if you look at the original monster list, it's basically all Greek, right? It's basically all Greek mythology stuff. And then everything else got layered on later of, you know, more exotic, horrible, Lovecraftian, you know, a beholder and a gelatinous cube and all that kind of stuff got layered on later. So you could also imagine this, you know, base level. Well, there are probably centaurs and fairies and elves. And then one layer behind that, it's much more horrible shit than that.
I mean, it's really fascinating to think of if all the monsters originally are Greek or possibly Roman, might I add? That when you say that our original setting, right, we're coming out of chainmail where our setting is medieval. That setting has always been fascinating to me. This idea of we're in medieval Europe, we understand medieval things, but also there are all these relics around of this ancient civilization that we don't understand.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's super cool.
And I think that, you know, if it's a challenging element and they couldn't be totally explicit about it, but you know, original D&D has clearly Catholic clerics. Mm-hmm. The clerics and all their titles, they're Catholic.
Yep.
And so it is kind of interesting how much you want to delve into that. If we're explicitly in medieval Catholic Europe, we're Christians, we explicitly don't believe in pagan stuff, but all around us is just all these pagan monsters, right? So you have these Christian clerics kind of crusading against these things that are not supposed to exist and that we're not supposed to admit exist or have power in the world.
Yep.
And that's actually all the monsters that we have to fight, is things that specifically argue against our faith system. Wow, I got deep on that.
That's great. That's a great study. And I would say it's pretty close, honestly, to what Lamentations of the Flame Princess is doing. If you read some of their adventures, a lot of the world of Lamentations of the Flame Princess is, in fact, just Europe. And a lot of the assumption is that, like, yeah, it's more or less like kind of medieval Europe, like with some fan, like, oh, there are elves and dwarves, I guess.
Yeah.
And then also then, like, oh, horrible, horrible things happen to you.
It's interesting because, you know, when I read original D&D, basically that's what I read. Now, obviously, I've removed clerics from my game, so that's not an immediate element, because it's partly because it's to the healing, the resurrection, the raising, and I don't want to have to deal with an actual Catholic-style infrastructure in my campaign world. So that doesn't immediately appear in my campaign. But when I open up the book, how I interpret what I see there.
I'll just make another shout out to the Warhammer setting, which, again, I love the Warhammer setting. I've yet to see a Warhammer RPG that I like really well in terms of mechanics. Although I haven't gotten to play it yet, but I am actually really interested in Small But Vicious Dog. Looks really good. Which is basically an amalgam of old school D&D and Warhammer. But one thing I really like about Warhammer is they sidestep all of this by just addressing Dear Reader, right? They when you're reading the book, there's definitely parts in it that are like, this is directed to you as the reader. You get to know this, but your characters don't know this, right? So, for example, all magic in Warhammer originates from chaos. There's this power of chaos. It makes demons, like when you're casting spells, you're talking to demons, blah, 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 blah. And when they get into the priests, it is often implied or directly stated, depending on which source you're looking at, the priests think they're talking to gods, but they're not. They're also tapping into chaos and talking to demons.
Interesting. Interesting.
Right. Interesting.
I mean, actually, no, that's actually an even stronger... Actually, I have so many reasons why not to have clerics. I mean, that's actually a stronger reason, is that I don't want proof that there are benevolent deities in my campaign world. Right. And what you just said is one way of going at that, but I kind of want it to be a little bit more obvious that my players have to deal with the fact that there isn't any proof of benevolent deities to help you out, and that the world is a little bit more horrible than that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it depends on what your source is for your deities, right? If you go back to, like, ancient Roman, ancient Greek mythology, those deities, are they benevolent?
Self-interested jerks. Best.
They're kind of self-interested probably. Jerks.
Right, right.
That's I'm down with those kind of deities. That's fun.
Right, right. I saw someone I saw someone yesterday. You know what Untitled Goose Game is?
No.
There's a video game out right now of where you play a goose that just screws everybody down.
Yeah.
Right. Someone made a joke of where they're going to make Untitled Zeus Game, right? of Zeus, you know, screwing over all his lovers in disguised form and stuff like that.
Great. That's great.
So you could play it that way. Then the mechanics of the D&D cleric, I don't think, look like Roman priests.
Yeah.
I don't normally think of like Roman or Greek pagan priests as wandering around in plate mail with a cross smiting the unbelievers.
Yep.
And that's, again, I think that's a point of tension of in standard D&D of is it, are they Catholic or not? And they kind of, that was always a point of tension for me.
Yep, for sure.
So on that point, okay, so mechanics, right? What mechanics support the horror theme? Like, so most horror-branded games that I know of, Call of Cthulhu, have a sanity mechanic, right?
Yep.
And your insanity cards, which are now on sale starting today, which are wonderful, and as I usually say, like anybody, any DM I've ever seen play with you, the next time I see them, they've bought insanity cards because it's such a great solution to that.
It is born of my dissatisfaction with the sanity mechanic in other games.
Yeah.
And I think when you talk about mechanics, right, that incite horror, number one, death has to be easy. And then number two, there has to be a good mechanized way for me to slowly lose control of my character into madness.
Okay. Right. Okay. So you feel that some kind of sanity mechanic is required for a real true horror game?
I like it a lot. I could imagine a game that doesn't have it. For example, the game Dread, I think does a pretty good job of not having that, of just having like, you're just going to die, right? It's more almost, maybe slasher flick-esque, right? Or at least that's the way people have run it for me. That's the way I've played is that it's just sort of like, oh, there's something's going to kill us. We're all going to die. Run until you die.
Right. Right. And I mean, for what it's worth, this morning I wound up, you know, if I attempt to argue that my games turn into horror all the time, you know, they turn into slasher movies, if anything. And not everybody likes those kinds of movies. But I was saying, you know, there's literally a lot of slashing in my games, right? There's a lot of people who actually get slashed up. And in my, at least in my D&D games, again, the deaths are going to be somewhat by surprise, and you're going to get a rather maybe unintentionally gory description from me. So maybe my games look more like slasher movies than anything, and maybe that doesn't count as really good horror. I don't know.
I don't good or bad. It's an eye of the beholder, right?
Right.
What I like about an insanity mechanic, and what I specifically like about my insanity cards, is that they represent a progression. So you're not just like fine. Oh, now I'm agoraphobic.
Mm-hmm.
right?
Which is a common D&D trope, right? Yeah. A common D&D trope that there's a spell or an effect, say versus spell, now you're insane.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
You're totally
yep.
out of control yep. of your character.
Yeah, that's a little weird. So I like yep. the I like a more gradual progression, so we can see the characters kind of slowly losing their grip on reality. And then the cards give the player specific prompts about behaviors to add to their roleplay. And it kind of gets back to what I was talking about that sort of practice of metagaming, right? The insanities are ultimately an excuse for you to make your character do really stupid things.
Right.
Right? Because you're like, well, my character's insane. So I'll give you an example. The mid-range paranoia says, pick a PC or NPC who's working against you, convince the others. Okay, well, now I got to pick someone in my group and be like, that guy wants us to die. He wants us to lose. And I got to convince everyone else of that fact. Right? And so now I'm looking for reasons to get alone with that person or sow dissent, right? Like, I'm not really helping the group anymore.
Right. But it is specific. It's developing more interactions.
Yep.
Specifically generating more connections and more interactions and pieces of business to actually happen. And when I was comparing your insanity card explicit directions like that to the classic D&D insanity list that's in the DM's guide, I was like, yeah, this is much more helpful for actually driving action in the game. Of it's kind of in the player's hands, but it's specific directions for new interactions with characters that's going to happen, and it's very productive at the table as a result.
Yeah, I mean, that's every now and then, and I think this is true in Call of Cthulhu too, right? Like, the insanities that you develop, like, you're wrestling with this stat, you're trying to keep your sanity, and, like, there's no effect, breaking point, everything's terrible.
Yes.
And then you roll on a chart, half of which the entries are like, what is that? What am I supposed to do with that? I'm not sure.
I agree. And likewise, one of the tracks in your cards is obsession.
Mm-hmm.
And likewise, halfway through, you're supposed to pick another player character and at one point keep them safe. And then later on, don't let them out of a room or something like that. And then later on, you just need to go to heaven together with them.
Yep.
I'm pretty sure that I think two or three times running in different games with you or other people using the insanity cards, other players picked my character as the target of their obsession. And every single time I didn't realize it.
That's
right.
Hilarious.
So time after time they got all the way to level 5 and I'm like, wow, hey, they're being really nice to me. That is very helpful. A very helpful, supportive party. I like this. Not splitting up the party. Things are looking well. And then in all three cases, they destroy us together. I'm like, I got fooled again. I don't know what my problem is. I don't know what my personal problem is not to recognize this
I don't know.
Over and over again.
It's color-coded and it's face up on the table. I mean...
But I'm so dense.
The funny thing is, especially you're playing with good players who are like really interpreting the cards and doing interesting things with them. Then it's very easy to lose sight and just stop looking. Even as DM, I've done that. I've occasionally been like, "What? You want to do what?" And then they're like, "Yeah, well, I have this insanity." And I look at their it all makes sense now. I see. Yes. That's totally what you do. I wrote a little bit of fiction on the front page of the insanity cards just to try and sell the idea of what they're about. And it's totally based on a real game that I played where one player character got decapitated, right, just through the deadliness of the game. Their head goes rolling to the feet of another player character. That player character takes a bunch of sanity damage and ends up deep in the delusions track of insanity. And the instruction is to start talking to someone or something that's not there. And so they were like, well, I'm just going to assume the head is, I mean, it's there, it's technically there, but I'm just going to like talk to him like he's still alive, right? Yeah. And so now this character is insane carrying around this severed head and talking to it, which is a great implementation of insanity. And the player who played the character who got decapitated said, can I roleplay the head?
Oh, no!
And we were all like, yes! Please roleplay the head.
No. Dan says no.
Oh, that's wonderful. It was just, we were all so pleased with that outcome. Like, that player still got to participate a little bit, even though their character was dead. only the other character could actually hear them, so they were still talking in the voice of the original character, but like everyone's like, you're insane, you're talking to a head. It's great.
That's really brilliant.
It was a wonderful moment.
That's really brilliant. I wonder, like, I feel like that's, I mean, those are those discoveries whereby, like, that needs to be, like, in a theatrical piece or something like that, of, like, yeah, that's really brilliant.
There was a movie, I think starring Joe Pesci, where he's traveling around with a duffel bag full of heads. Have you seen that?
Yeah.
I can't remember, but basically he starts to lose his shit and starts talking to them.
Oh, really?
And they talk back, and it's...
Oh, no.
It's wonderfully dark and hilarious.
Nasty.
Yeah. So here's a funny point. You know, all these things that we're talking about that I love in horror, most of them are actually kind of funny. I would say, like, I really like dark humor. And I want to see that come out in my... In most of my horror games, people are laughing hard.
I totally get that. I totally get that. And, you know, that's common, I think, in horror movie theater presentations. That's pretty common. And again, like, I actually get really bothered by that. I get really, honestly, very bothered by people laughing in a theater at horror movies. I feel somehow it goes down a lot better for me at a table. Somewhat, just a little bit. I need to be a little bit more removed from it, I guess, in order to enjoy that. And that's common. And again, you know, in the Liberian Fritz Lieber's works, there's a lot of horrible things happening. It tends to get played sort of for humor, and I feel like that's almost the essential D&D experience of horrible things that all the players are actually laughing at. Yeah. And you kind of do need that. Like, I would have a real hard time doing that with an Arsonian, you're playing yourself. Like, yeah. I feel like I would get really weirded out by that.
I totally agree, right? And it gets back to that sort of, like, it is metagaming, right? It's that's what I like about it in role-playing, is that we have this built-in separation between us and our characters, and we're kind of delighting in it now.
Right.
So if you're going for super immersive, then, you probably don't want people laughing at the horrible moments.
Right. Right, but with that one step removed, there's a lot of. I mean, that's maybe the number one joyous thing about the hobby, is you get to explore these experiences at a slightly safer move. Mm-hmm. And so for our brothers and sisters that are on the spectrum or something like that, here's a way to test out these kinds of social experiences about what's okay or what's too much, before you actually put yourself in the world in that kind of situation, maybe. And that's, I think, like, that's a really, you know, the horror theme is a really good example of, like, how okay are you with that? And, you know, it's not like it's a stage performance, and it doesn't take, if you need to stop it or X-card it or something like that, it's a lot easier than some other experience. Like, if you're in a movie or you're on a ride, right?
Like a haunted house ride or a dark room ride
kind
of thing.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You can't get out of the situation at that point for those of us who are more sensitive.
Yeah.
And so the tabletop experience, and you're face to face and everybody is cooperating, is a lot better way to test the boundaries on that, I think.
Awesome. Yeah.
So there's a lot of stuff in gaming that I would never have been comfortable with in other circumstances.
Funny.
And you bring it into my gaming, and I can find a way to possibly engage and enjoy it that I couldn't in other media.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So we've gone a little longer than we usually do. So but before we end, do you want to talk a little bit about the Patreon stuff going on?
I thank you for reminding me about that, Paul.
Mm-hmm.
So we're closing in on, we're coming up towards the end of 2019, which is our first year of Wandering DM. So we're calling this our first season. And I think we started right after the 1st of January. So for this year, our last show is going to be Sunday, December 8th is what we're planning on. And then we will take, if I recall, we will take a brief break for the holidays. And then we will return next year in 2020 for season 2 of Wandering DMs, and we're planning lots of new exciting topics and more special guests and convention videos and wandering about the globe for new videos for that.
Yeah, should be very exciting. So hopefully whet your appetite a bit for those couple of weeks at the end of December when you have to live without us. But we'll be, I'm sure, recharging our batteries and thinking of all kinds of new, exciting things to incorporate into the show.
Right.
But if you can't wait, maybe there's something else you could do.
What would that be, Paul?
That would be join our Patreon. So go to our Patreon page, become a patron, and we will be releasing towards the end of the year our first exclusive patron-only video. I believe you and I are going to talk about...
Dyson's Delve,
yes.
Right.
For those who have seen our live played game back in July of Dyson's Delve, Dan and I are going to dissect it from both DM view and player view, and we'll be posting that video up on our Patreon for our patrons only.
Right. So if you do want to see what we expect to be a fascinating analysis of what we were ourselves really impressed by, a really great D&D mini mega dungeon by Dyson Logos, please come join us. And again, that would be patreon.com/wanderingdms, where you can become a patron and join in that exclusive content.
Excellent. There was something else before we ended that we were supposed to talk about. I'm not remembering what it was. Insanity cards?
Yes.
I don't know if that's really true or not, but I'll plug them one more time. Insanity cards.
Yeah, remind us.
This is the mini version of Insanity cards. It's a new, smaller deck. It's on crowd sale right now at the Game Crafter, thegamecrafter.com/crowdsales/mini-insanity cards. Or the easiest way to find it is just go to my blog, paulsgameblog.com/insanity cards. All kinds of info about them there.
Great. That's great. Yeah, it's a great product, and you should totally look for that. I'm glad that you're making it in the new... regular poker-sized format, like, so for people like me, I can shuffle it more easily.
Yeah, it's easier to handle, easier to fit on your table if you don't have an enormous gaming table, and it's a little cheaper too. So,
I will say that if you go to my house, go ahead, Paul.
Sorry, no, go on.
If you go to my house rules at oedgames.com and you dig into the original edition Delta House Rules, I will say that Paul's Insanity cards are the officially recommended sanity mechanic for original edition Delta D&D brand.
Awesome. Upcoming conventions. We will be at PAX Unplugged in December. So if you're there, come look for us.
Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and first weekend in December, I think.
Yep.
So we'll be joining that for the first time and getting to find out what that's all about.
And then in February, we'll be at TotalCon in Mansfield, Massachusetts, and be running games there. I will certainly be running actually quite a ridiculous number of games there. And I'm sure we will, again, film our impressions of the convention on site.
Right. I believe you've registered to run 7 games at TotalCon.
Yeah, 24 hours of games. 24 hours
yeah.
of games.
Yeah. So I will be there occasionally, I think once or twice, playing the adversary and handing Paul snacks and making sure that he's hydrated.
Excellent. All right, so that I think wraps up our show. Any final thoughts, Dan, on horror in D&D or horror in games in general?
I feel like D&D right out of the box is 1/6 pretty horrible already.
Yeah.
And I'm happy to dig into that vein, and I'm also happy to explore other games like you run, which is way more committed to it.
Yeah, if any one of our viewers has more thoughts on horror in D&D or other horror games or how to intermix the two, please post us your thoughts in the comment section below. We'd love to hear from you.
I would love to see that. I'm still learning about what really counts as horror. I would like to hear if people think that what I do counts as horror or not. That seems like an interesting question for people who are more informed than I am. So, yeah. And also, remember that you can like and follow and subscribe to us on YouTube and Twitter and Twitch by the handle Wandering DMs.
Audio-only podcast versions of our show are available in all the fine podcast purveyors online, as well as on our own website at wanderingdms.com.
That's right. And again, thanks to our patrons who do support the show. And if you'd like to join them again, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. Remember that we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. Now, next Sunday, I believe clocks change for daylight savings time.
Ooh,
so be careful about the time change. But we will be next week will be 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time is the plan. So please join us next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.